Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Hello and thank you for joining us today. I'm John Shepherd with Andy Fenton. So in Ridgeway Magazine, what have we got? As always, a very varied menu with voices and their stories and guests giving advice while telling us something we don't know. So we start with Weymouth. How has the town's hospitality sector coped this year? And we take B&Bs first. Why have they asked for rent reductions from the district council landlord? We take another look at buying a car with a warning from Dorset Trading Standards that everything under the bonnet may not be as it should be. And we hear the amazing tale of the one-time umbrella girl and her dramatic escape from a war in the desert.
And to gentler pursuits, Ruth Hayes, our gardening guru, is in the studio to talk to us about lawns. And while on the subject, author, lecturer and organic gardener Val Bourne makes a welcome return to the programme to unveil the mystery of the minor bees, foreigners that have taken up residence in Dorset. Finally, we hear about the dumbest criminals in the experience of a former Los Angeles police prosecutor. So now, on with the show, and summer is a recent memory. The heat of June and July replaced by the autumn chill. Sounds lyrical, but what has been the reality of the 6 months of lockdown and distancing regulations on seaside visits and holidays in Weymouth? Still, the cruise ships are floating majestically in the bay, which have in themselves provided an unexpected tourist attraction, with boat trips taking visitors for a cruise around the cruisers. We should be grateful for the antics of the visiting porpoises, which have greatly amused the visitors as they, the porpoises that is, cavort a short distance from the shore. At the beginning of the year, when Ridgeway Magazine interviewed organisers of forthcoming events at the reception at the pavilion, everything was set fair for an estimated 1 million visitors. And then, disaster, as the dreaded virus saw the cancellation of events one after the other. No more military parades or beach volleyball, no Ironman challenge, sailing events cancelled and attractions closed for the better part of the summer. So how's it been for Weymouth's hotels and B&Bs? Not as busy as usual, many told us. For the overall picture, we asked Claire Wall, chair of the Weymouth Hotels, Guesthouses and Leaseholders Association, for her take on 2020 so far. But the sting is in the tail of the interview.
So here's how it is. One in four of the town's 170 B&Bs are owned by Dorset Council. They used to be owned by the former Weymouth and Portland District Council, but ownership passed to the newly constituted Unitary Authority 18 months ago. The association is in negotiation over the payment of rents to the council because many hospitality businesses are in dire financial straits. You see, B&Bs are family concerns in the main, into which savings have been poured. Now, even when business is bad, as it has been, the rent and bills still have to be paid. In the past, the situation has been them and us, council on one side and the tenants on the other. So when the subject of leases has been discussed, Claire Wall, well, she can take up the story. Well, we last spoke in December and we were looking forward on behalf of Weymouth's 170 B&Bs and small hotels to a great new year. Oh dear, what's it really been like?
Well, what can we say? It was frustrating. There's a lot of anxiety. We were all stressed, worried. We just didn't know what was going to happen with our livelihoods, our business, or any of the future. We just couldn't see anything ahead. But we managed to work through it, all pull together, and hopefully we'll all survive.
Well, I mean, survival is a wonderful word that everybody's using these days. But what about the business of running B&Bs? I mean, what about your occupancy, for instance? What's it been like this year?
Well, we didn't take anything from March the 23rd when we went into lockdown. We were allowed to open from the 4th of July. It was a quiet couple of weeks into July. We thought the phone would be constantly ringing or the online booking agents would be booking. It was quiet, and then all of a sudden it just hit. And we were really good with the bookings, and we were all helping each other and passing people on if we were full and helping each other fill up, and it was really good.
I think you said that you were getting close to 100% occupancy for 6 or 7 glorious weeks.
Yes, we were running at 92% occupancy for July, August.
And the same for the rest of the town?
Yeah, we were all helping each other out. Some were doing not so many rooms and working to their guidelines with their accommodation. But yeah, we were all really good and getting people in.
I mean, that really is the problem, isn't it? I mean, if I were to book into a B&B, what could I expect in terms of distancing? How does it work?
Well, we put all measures in place. We put the signage there. We put the floor stuff there. We met and greeted. We couldn't meet for too long, so the actual experience we usually give as a guest house we couldn't give because we needed to not interact as much, but we did it as comfortably and as best we could in the safest way possible.
And what about seating people for breakfast, for instance?
A majority of us didn't feel comfortable with doing the sit down usual full English breakfast. For me and myself, we decided our dining room, it wouldn't be suitable for the rooms we've got to do that social distancing. So we put breakfast baskets on. Some people did room only. Some did do have still done the full English breakfast and put whatever safety measures they felt comfortable at the time for their guests.
So in terms of the experience then, it wasn't as you would have liked it. What about the winter's coming? And although I've noticed a number of coaches dropping people off today, and it's a windy, rather rainy afternoon, of course, it's fictitious because those coaches which could seat, 60 people, probably only bring in 20.
Yes, they've had to work and adhere to the government guidelines.
So in the winter, I mean, presumably in good times, you had enough reserves to survive a quiet winter. Can't be true this time, though, can it? I should think that some of the B&Bs must be running pretty well close to empty in terms of cash.
Yes, everybody is worried about the winter, and we're just hoping we can all help each other through and we all survive it.
Now, most of the B&Bs, I think I'm right in saying, are rented or leased, aren't they, from Dorset Council? I mean, the rent man, of course, always wants his money. So what are you doing about that? Because if difficult times have been experienced by practically everybody, what on earth are you going to do in terms of paying the rent?
We are in talks with Dorset Council, and we're hoping to come up with some agreement which will work best for both ways, for them and us, and that's still ongoing, so there's no actual outcome to be able to give that forward yet.
And how do you feel about that? Are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful that this new Dorset Council, what was formed, will be supportive and work with us. That's what we all want. It's always been a them and us attitude from the old Weymouth Town Council, and it just wears you down, and people have just come together and we're all standing together. We're fed up of this attitude. We want to work together to make this place the best it can be.
And I think you said that you've got, 40-odd members, and in fact, you know, with any organisation, there's always people who know better than everybody else. There's always a rump of people who don't want to do this and don't want to do that. But in fact, as regards your members, you're saying they're far more united than ever before.
Yes, we are. We've all helped each other. If one guest house member has felt a bit down, we've pulled together. We've had Zoom meetings. We've come together as an association to help and support each other the best way we can.
Now, one thing that hasn't changed, of course, and we were talking about this at the end of last year, is what do people do in Weymouth when it rains? There's not a lot to do, is there? We've lost our bowling alley. I mean, don't you feel very frustrated that there's this huge pavilion site and nothing on it still?
Yes, we've all felt the same. We've all had the same feelings. We've all had the thoughts. We just want Weymouth to be as good as it can be, and it needs some investment. And hopefully, if we all work together, we can get a better Weymouth.
So, are there any sort of pressure groups involved in trying to bring about change?
We have all got ideas, and there has been discussions, but it all has to go through the right procedure, the right people, and it has to be what's good for the pocket and Weymouth.
Now, what do you think the latest rules are going to be? That pubs are going to close at 10 o'clock, restaurants are going to have to close at 10 o'clock. I mean, what effect is that going to have on the town? Because there is a night-time economy in Weymouth, isn't there?
Yes, it will affect the town, there's no doubt about that, and I feel really upset that it's still affecting hospitality, even though when they've been hit hard from the 3 month shutdown, they're starting to make a comeback, and now there's further restrictions given to them. So yeah, it does need looking at, and that we do need to get through this, all of us.
Well, anyway, Claire, well, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine, and I do wish you was a happier message. But people are still arriving, people are still staying here, so let's hope for the best, shall we? When Ridgeway Magazine asked Dorset Council to put up an official for interview about position of BOB, B&Bs, small hotels who've got council leases and who might be having difficulty in paying the rent, no one was available to come onto the show to talk to us. However, in a brief written statement, I was told the council had administered the government's business loan scheme, which provided cash grants to businesses in need of support. And it added in the statement that the council has already offered deferral of rent to its hotel and guest house tenants and will be working on an individual basis with affected tenants to provide further support. However, this message does not seem to have reached the Weymouth Association. That's the association governing leasehold B&Bs and small hotels. Now, this is strange because I've been told of a communication from the council which indicates they are taking a look at all their assets but cannot cherry-pick any one sector over another, which in plain English suggests Weymouth's hospitality businesses will have to wait in line for the assessments to take place.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
Well, we've talked a great deal about subjects to do with motoring, and it is small wonder the subject is front of mind when you consider one car is registered for every two adults in this overcrowded country of ours. Or here's another statistic, 31 million cars for 20 million households. In recent programmes, we've dealt with car insurance scams, the ghost insurance brokers who take motorists for a ride, and also tricksters who sell cars that they don't own but look nice in a cloned picture on a garage forecourt, also cloned. In our last programme, we covered the subject of the second-hand vehicle market and mentioned the fact used car prices have and are increasing at the rate of 7%. The reason? Dealers have been short of stock, given people are choosing to drive to work rather than go by public transport and need perhaps a second car, or perhaps a more reliable one. And then there's the case of the white van man. Sales of vans have literally gone through the roof, and to comply with the explosion of home deliveries, many who might have lost their jobs have turned delivery driver. All of which takes us to a warning issued by Dorset Trading Standards following a four-month survey it commissioned earlier this year. Its results showed Dorset residents could be buying unsafe used cars. Clearly, a case not only of buyer beware, but also keep death off the roads. Here's the frightening statistic that the research threw up. Of the 129 inspected vehicles being offered for sale, a whopping 43 were unsafe and would not have passed an MOT, and therefore could not be driven on the road. If these cars were purchased by unsuspecting customers, the financial cost to them totaled a third of £1 million, £360,000 to be exact. And you try and get your money back from a dodgy car dealer? Well, it was all right when it left here, Gov.
And so it was. So what are the most common faults? One or 40 tars were probably at the top of the list. A favourite dodge is to fit used cars with tyres which look good but don't match, and by that I mean different makes of tyre with different quality and different wear patterns. Another is to misrepresent the mileage and the vehicle's history. People don't realise that it's a simple matter to check the car's MOT history online, which will give you the correct mileage and the reason for any MOT failure, and these are listed in full. The service is free and a click away on your computer or smartphone. You can also check for yourself if the car is subject to a current hire purchase agreement, which means that even if you pay for it, you will not own it, particularly if there are payments outstanding. The service is not free, but only costs a few pounds and well worth checking. Other faults found by trading standards, including fitting faulty or non-standard parts, turning the mileage back thousands of miles, and that's called clocking. The report also highlighted what were called administration charges imposed by dealers on sales. Now, these are illegal, and one dealer, must have been quite a big dealer, was cited as making a £99 surcharge on every sale, which might have netted him, if he wasn't spotted, £400,000 a year. Now, the wise buyer can get a car inspected by the RAC or the AA. An improved inspector will check the car over and take it for a test run. The AA charges £176 for this service, and provides a verbal report followed by a detailed written report with photos. They told me that in coastal areas like Dorset, one problem the AA looked for was corrosion of mechanical and structural parts of a vehicle caused by the salty atmosphere here. So now you know. So buyer beware. And happy motoring.
Well, while on the subject of motoring, to the delight of many and the chagrin of locals who cherish all things historical, at last the rails from the disused railway line running beside the harbour and along Commercial Road in Weymouth are to be removed. The line, which served the cross-channel ferry service from Weymouth to the Channel Islands, was last used commercially in 1999. It's hard to believe that trains used to wind their way at walking pace the 1.5 miles from the station to the quayside, having started their journey in Waterloo. Badly parked cars would have to be bounced out of the way for the progress of the train to make sure it wasn't impeded. The removal of the track has divided opinion in the town for many years. A petition against the plan at one time collected 4,000 signatures. Historians fumed while cyclists tumbled and cartwheeled on the wet rails. Others pointed out that the cost, over £1.25 million, could be better spent on things that really matter at this time. On Monday, October the 5th, work commences with the first phase starting at the King Street end of Commercial Road, with the lower part of King Street being closed for 3 days. Parts of Commercial Road, as far as Customs House Quay, will be closed on a rolling basis until the whole road up to the Cousins Quay car park will be derailed and resurfaced at the end of November. Rail removal along Custom House Quay to the Pavilion will start early next year. Look out for diversions for the next 2 months or so, and be prepared for long traffic queues if past road improvements are anything to go by. The timing is hardly going to help Weymouth's hard-pressed traders, who are well aware that any roadworks always take longer and cause more disruption than planned. Or should that read unplanned?
Oh, I'd like to know whether it's planned or unplanned, Andy. Anyway, now here's a story about a politically correct, all-inclusive, non-sexist, etc., etc., rule introduced a short while ago to reduce the visible glamour surrounding motor racing, both cars and superbikes, on the basis that too much bodywork on show was a bad thing in this day and age of giving offence where none was intended. Whatever became of the Pirelli calendar, which graced countless garage workshops, not to mention the Page Three girls and the 1940s pin-ups, popped and consigned to history. I start my talk on the racing circuit, but the interview takes a dramatic turn in a very unexpected way, so do keep listening. Well, hands up at the back. Who knows what an umbrella girl is? Because sitting in my garden, in broad sunlight, there is one. Carrie Ann Watkins. Put me out of my agony. Tell me.
Hi, good morning, John. Well, I love how you say it's an umbrella girl because we're actually known as Brolly Dollies back in the day. Obviously, I'm from the Midlands, so that was our actual title, which is, yes, let's hire a Brolly Dolly for the start of the racing season.
Right, so now we've taken several leaps there. First of all, what racing was it, and where, how, and when?
I was a Brolly Dolly for Formula One each year in August in the UK, which was a massive event at the time, and Northamptonshire it's under, and I did a lot of racing for superbikes, British superbikes as well, which was obviously motorcycles, which I loved.
So, now tell me about the Brolly.
The Brolly was used really to keep the sun off the biker in the bike events. Formula One, it was basically to look glamorous. We were paid to stand there, look good and smile and basically warm up everybody for the start of the race. So we were normally there for about half an hour prior to the event where we'd stand and we'd talk to whoever we were, you know, looking after, what racer. And then we'd warm the crowd up for the start of the race, which was fantastic. The atmosphere was unbelievable.
Of course, I can remember that there are always pictures in racing motorcycle magazines of the Brolly Dollies.
Yes.
You know, it's all part of the scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, back in the early 90s, you were allowed to do a hell of a lot more than you're allowed to today. Well, as we know today, in most of the racing events, it's actually stopped. In superbikes, it still goes on. But I really feel sad that in Formula One, it's stopped totally now. And that's really, really sad because I've got so many great and fantastic memories of being a Brolly Dolly at the Grand Prix and the after parties and mingling with drivers and all different kinds of people from all different walks of life. And it's fantastic. And I find it really sad now that stopped. And a lot of agencies that I used to work for, and I have friends that run agencies, they're out of work because there just isn't the work out there for glamorous promo girls and Brolly Dollies anymore, and it's a bit tragic really.
I suppose we've got to talk about short shorts and short skirts, but your umbrellas, do they have signage on them? Do they have advertising on them?
Yeah, we did advertise a lot. In most racing events, it was either equipment, it could have been an energy drink. And to be honest with you, I'm a non-smoker. But back in the day, it was promoting cigarettes, which I just do not agree with, being an anti-smoker. But that was massive. That was massive back in the day. Marlboro, people probably remember this, the Marlboro girls went all over the UK and abroad doing that. I was offered to do that, but I declined because I couldn't promote something that I didn't believe in myself at the end of the day.
Now, in terms of working at the racetrack, I think you told me that you just had to get there. There were no excuses.
No, I did the Grand Prix in 94, and it was a really, really bad weather day. It was just raining, and I couldn't drive, so I was driving along from Daventry, and I couldn't see. So basically, I pulled over, and I walked around 3.5 miles to get to work because I wasn't going to let the agent down. And to be honest with you, if I say I'm going to be somewhere to do a job, I'm there no matter what. If Carrie Ann doesn't turn up, then there's something wrong. And, you know, rain, snow, whatever, I will get there somehow, believe me.
And also, not only motorcycles, you also did promotional work for a car company, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked a lot for Audi. I also did a little bit for Mercedes. Cool, I'd love to do that now, believe me. But, you know, I promoted from crisps to top-of-the-range motorcycles. I was also a Guinness girl for 5 years, where we did a lot of Guinness events and black velvet events, which is Guinness and champagne. And we would go down to London and we would have to wear a black dress, black stockings, black stilettos, and a lot of us had dark hair and red lipstick. And it was all part of the being a Guinness girl.
I thought you were going to say for a moment, black everywhere except for a white hat to indicate the foam.
Yeah, we probably did look a bit like that. I mean, it people wanted a certain criteria for each product. So, and do you know what? A lot of the time it worked. You know, there's some amazing marketing companies, and a pretty face, a smile and a personality went a long way. Towards the end of the 90s, we did have to have a lot of product knowledge regarding the cars or the motorcycles. So we'd go for like a week away training and we'd learn what engine size, you know, what spec the car came in. So we wasn't just the as people were pointing out, the bimbo on the stand. We knew what we were talking about, which was, to be honest with you, I found really interesting because I love fast cars and I love fast bikes. So I found that brilliant.
No, propriety forbids me from calling you a fast lady, but I mean, do you have a motorbike?
Being in the field of working with fast cars and fast bikes, I was always the bird on the back of the bike. And with a lot of my ex-partners, they all had sports bikes. And I thought, I'm sick of this. I'm going to be the girl taking control. And I did my direct access course and I went straight onto a 500. And then from 500, I went onto a 1000 Fireblade. And now, because of my my knee problem, I've gone onto an MT10 Yamaha, which has got an R1 engine. So it is really, really quick and it's lush.
And is it noisy?
I've got to be honest, well, it is quite noisy, so I normally come down the end of the street before I start the engine, not to annoy the neighbours.
Now, here's where the interview takes a dramatic turn, which just goes to show everyone has a story.
You know, it's very strange, but when you start talking to people, you very often get to the real story. Now, we've been talking to Carrie-Anne Watkins about being a brolly dolly and about shielding motor racers from the sun and the elements and being very glamorous. But your story actually has a very dramatic turn when you were a young woman.
Yeah, I was 11 when I went to live with my father in Kuwait, who was an engineer over there at the time with my stepmom. I had an amazing life out there. I loved it. I loved the expat community. And then one night I had gone out to a party with friends and I was 16 at the time. And I came back and it was about, I think, about 2:15 in the morning on the 2nd of August 1990. The phone rang and I thought, oh, this is a bit late. I hope Dad's not hearing the phone ringing. And it was my dad. And I didn't realise that he was at work. And he said, look, you need to wake your stepmom up, Linda, because Iraq has invaded Kuwait within the early hours. And I was like, Dad, I've just come in from a party. Is this serious? What? To be honest, I was away with the fairies. And he said, no, Carrie, wake her up now. Iraq has invaded Kuwait. I'm getting some stuff sorted and I'm coming straight home. We need to think about what we're, you know, what we're going to do. And that's how it all started. The Iraq invaded Kuwait. And then we put the radio on, Radio World Service, BBC World Service, and every hour was Iraq has invaded Kuwait. If America or the UK intervene, they will turn Kuwait into a graveyard. And we were hearing that every day from the 2nd of August going into when we decided to escape on the 14th of August, which was my dad's plan.
So, well, you make it sound very simple. Now, I can't really visualise what you must have gone through, because I mean it's desert, so it's not sort of nice countryside or anything like that where presumably you could hide. So how did you get away? What plans did you have?
There was gossip of them doing a lot of horrid things to women, especially Kuwaiti women in Kuwait and around our area. We lived in an area called Jabriya. And basically, we had two little cars. And my dad said, if we're going to go over the desert, because he knew all the deserts anyway, from Kuwait into Saudi, that he'd need to get hold of a four-wheel drive. And a friend of his had one that was left. And my dad hotwired this. It was back then called a Mitsubishi Shogun. I think they're called Pajeros now. And he hotwired one and brought it round. And for the first 10 days, we were locked down. We couldn't leave our villa. And we had to live on the food that we had because there was no shops. We had to live on the water that was left. I mean, it, all joking aside, it was really scary. We couldn't phone anybody for help. We couldn't even phone anybody local to talk about what was going on. And my dad said, you know, if we stay here, we don't know if we're going to get out. So I'm going to save my daughter, save my wife. And we had a Persian cat at the time called Misu. We'll take the cat. So he was worried about me being young, and I had long black hair and I didn't look like a boy, but he decided to say, right, okay, on the 14th we're going to get up, I've hotwired this four-wheel drive, we'll put what food we've got left in, and we're going to go over to Saudi. So he said, Carrie, you need to put this baseball cap on. He put some boot polish on my face, an old baggy shirt and some awful tatty jeans, and we went. We got in the four-wheel drive. We went over the border to Saudi. But just before we got there, my dad had gone wrong. And he saw these troops come towards us. And we just thought, this is it. You know, these are Iraqi troops. They're not troops that are going to help us or save us. He got out. My dad speaks a lot of Arabic. And they said, look, we don't want to hurt you. He was an Iraqi young lad. He was 15 at the time. And he said, you know, Saddam and their captains had sent them out to the desert. They didn't want to be there. But if they'd have gone back and not done what they were told to do, they'd have been shot. All they wanted was some of our water and some of our, like, a naan bread that we had. And they said to my dad, you're going the wrong way. And they actually gave him the right directions and to the border. And we arrived in Saudi. The Saudi people were fantastic with us because they knew what was going on. They gave us free food. They gave us water. They gave us loads more bread. And they gave us cans of 7-Up, which was quite funny, because they said that they had another family that had arrived a couple of hours before us, a family of four as well. And they'd given them loads of 7-Up and bread and everything else. So, you know, we went from there, and then we stayed in Saudi for a couple of hours. Then we travelled on to Bahrain. Bahrain, they put us up. They were fantastic. And then we got in hold of the British Embassy, and they sent a flight for us back to Gatwick.
So, I mean, you make it sound sort of quite romantic, but, I mean, it must have been frightening at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you think every hour you're listening to a radio station that's saying they will turn Kuwait into a graveyard, you don't know. What happened was, when they came, the Kuwaiti army fled. They just left us there. So we didn't have anybody. We didn't know if anybody was coming to help or what was going on. At the middle of the night, what was happening, the Emir of Kuwait was telling all of his people to fight for Kuwaiti freedom. It was this horrendous noise and all this shouting and fire shooting. We thought it was actually troops coming to kind of take us, but it was the Emir sending like a satellite or something and people shouting free Kuwait. We actually thought, oh my god, you know, are we gonna, we just stayed in our villa. And it was, so some nights we did think, you know, is this it? You know, a few nights my stepmum, bless her, suffered really badly with anxiety, hence why she wouldn't escape on the 13th, because she thought it was bad luck, and we had to wait till the 14th. My mum back in the UK, I mean, when I actually got home to the Midlands, I mean, my mum was in such a state, and the whole of the neighbourhood came out and they wanted to give me a hug, and it was pretty remarkable. But you know, we were lucky. Others weren't lucky at all, and there's some horrific stories. But at the end of the day, what doesn't kill you can only make you stronger.
Well, what a story. How to follow that? Well, now for something completely different. As the saying goes, in the studio, for the first time in 6 months, we welcome Ruth Hayes, our gardening expert, with a slight change of plan. Now, she was going to talk about taking cuttings part two, having dealt with plants in the last programme in part one. But Ruth has decided a more timely subject is the lawn in autumn. So if you have one, this is for you. And we'll hear more about cuttings in our next programme. So, Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Andy. Lovely to see you both again. Yes, lawns in winter. Basically, in the autumn, we do our lawn work, we feed it, we prepare it, we scarify it, get rid of all the dead moss and grass, and then we just leave it alone. Leave it alone for the winter, because it's a tough time for lawns. There's a lot of rain, they get waterlogged, and if you walk on them, they're going to get all soggy and churned up. When it freezes, if you walk on the lawn, then your footprints will kill the grass and just leave black trails. Yes, yeah, it damages the blades. And then they don't grow back very well, and they can just turn black and mushy. So that's why we stay off the lawn in winter. But in late autumn now, you've done your feeding, you've done your raking, there are a few things you should be doing, a few final things, just to prep the lawn up for the coming months. Obviously now the trees are beginning to shed their leaves, which is lovely. We can crunch through them and we can collect them up and make leaf mould. But ideally, don't leave them lying on your lawn, because they block the sunlight and they block air getting down to the grass blades. And they're also a perfect little hiding place for pests. And when they get damp and mouldy and horrible, they get lots of disease spores, fungal spores sort of lurk in them, and they will transfer to the grass, and you'll end up with lots of sort of mushy grey, black, yellow, nasty patches of grass. In the worst case scenario, it'll die right back and you're just left with muddy patches. So rake up your leaves. And if you've got the space, store them for leaf mould. Either put them in a black bin liner, punch holes in the bin liner, put a bit of water in and tie up the neck of the bag. Store them somewhere safe, and in a couple of years' time, you'll have lovely leaf mould for your borders.
So it's a wait and see. Can I just ask you, yes. Can we just backtrack one? Because not everybody is familiar with the process of scarifying. So could you please tell us?
Sorry, yes, of
course. Do we need a special piece of equipment?
No, you just need a garden rake. Just want, you know, one of the sort of bouncy rakes, the sort of big wide ones, and just go over the grass with it. And as you do so, as you pull it along, you'll notice lots of dead grass matter and moss is collected up. And by getting rid of that, you improve the airflow and you make it easier for rainwater to get down to the roots of the grass. So it keeps the grass healthy, keeps it growing well. And what you collect up, you can just pop on your compost heap if you have one.
I mean, moss is a danger, isn't it? What does moss do? Does it sort of encompass the grass and stop it growing? I mean,
well, basically, moss is a real opportunist. And if you haven't got a healthy grass and it's not growing strongly, moss will just colonise the areas where the grass is, you know, has disappeared. It's not a massive problem. If it's only in small patches, you can. I mean, there's lots of grass food with moss killer built into it that you can use in autumn and spring to get rid of your moss, and then you can reseed the dead areas with grass seed. But if it gets too much, it can sort of compact the soil, and it's not an ideal situation, really.
Right. So that's moss. Actually, should we be killing? Using weed killer, and I have to say that thinking about hedgehogs, presumably weed killer, I mean, this is going on to another subject, which I apologise.
No, it's all good. Right.
Does it affect the hedgehogs and cats and dogs, weed killer?
I've never actually looked into that, but I would suspect not, because it's probably been... A lot of them these days are made to be safe to use around children and pets. But you wouldn't use it at this time of year anyway, because your grass isn't growing very well. Weeds aren't really growing very well. So it's best now just to leave your lawn alone. If you do have a weed problem, you can get some... You can get these pullers that you can pull out individual big weeds like thistles and chickweed and things. But otherwise, I would leave it and really... crack on with the work in spring, because that's when the grass is starting to grow again and the weeds are starting to grow again, and whatever you use would be more effectively taken in by the plants. And as we always say, never just use a general weed killer, always use one for specific lawn weeds, because a general weed killer will kill your grass as well.
I see. So. Actually, I get to have a diversion just for a moment. Don't buy cheap implements. No. I bought a weed puller, I think you call it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's sort of sharp.
Yes, and you put your foot on it and then lever it up and...
Yeah, that's what I did.
Oh, dear.
And the thing got stuck. It sort of left the handle and got stuck in the garden. The other thing I bought, actually, from a shop which is now closed, incidentally, Value House, I think it was called, I bought some shears, which you use for doing the edging.
Yes, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, well, they lasted two turns, actually.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's false
Don't
economy.
I know.
Cheap. You think, yes.
Anyway, we better get back to lawns. Now, what about spiking your lawn?
Yes.
Making holes in it,
aerating. That is a good thing to be doing before autumn. Aerating, there's lots of ways you can do it. Well, there's three main ways you can do it. You can do it with your big garden fork, just ram it into the grass a few inches deep. You can buy special aerating machines as well that you just roll over the grass. And you can also buy spiked shoes that you can just walk over the lawn and make the holes for you, which is a fairly...
Golfers and gophers.
Aerating is good because if your lawn are prone to puddling and collecting water, and they're quite compacted. Aerating just helps the water go away. It helps it absorb. It increases ventilation around the grass. So it's a good thing to do, but don't do it when the damage is done and your lawn is already waterlogged.
Okay, well, I think are we more or less coming to the end of our lawn at the moment?
I could go on for a minute.
All right, for a minute.
What I would say is you can still mow, because grass will grow when the temperature's mild enough, which our winters do seem to be increasingly mild at the moment. So do mow, which will take care of your weeds as well, but have your mower blades on a high setting so you don't churn up the soil.
Right. Okay, now look, Ruth, don't go away, because the next subject is loosely about lawns. Over to you, Andy.
Well, yes, we stay with nature as we talk to Val Bourne, author and colleague of Ruth's on Amateur Gardening magazine, and ask for an explanation about the busy buzzers hovering over lawns this month. John talked to her by telephone.
There's a mystery in my road. I'm sure it's not the only road, with tiny little flies, well, they look like flies, which hover above the grass. I'm very lucky to live in a road where the front gardens have not all been given over to carports and things, so there's a fair amount of grass around. But what are these little things? I can't make up my mind if flies, wasps or bees.
Well, when you first talked about them, John, I was completely baffled because it's something that I hadn't seen. So I have a friend who is the... recorder for Bee Wars, which is Bee, Wasp and Ant Recording Society, and his name is Jeremy Early. And I sent him an email. He gardens in Reigate in Surrey, and he actually wrote a very good book called My Side of the Fence. And he told me that they were ivy bees. The Latin name is Colitis hederi, and they fly from September to mid-November. And the reason they're called ivy bees is because they like to feed on ivy flowers. So you'll see them at this time of year. If you've got ivy flowers out, you might well see them. And they are bees, and they are actually a mining bee, and they are the latest flying mining bee of all, because most bees have gone to bed by now.
I see.
So they're a really excellent bee in autumn. And it reminded me, actually, of a visit that I made to Corfe Castle when there were some enormous ivy bushes. And ivy, the clinging ivy is the sort of juvenile stage, but when the ivy gets a bit more mature, it produces woody stems and flowers, and once these are pollinated, they produce berries. And because the flowers are so late, we went to Corfe Castle in October... last year or the year before, and it was absolutely full of pollinators, and I do wonder whether we saw the ivy bees on there. So it's a very good plant. But they're actually not British natives. They arrived here in 2001, and they were first spotted in Dorset. Now, I'm not sure where you live, John.
We live in Weymouth.
Oh, well, I hope I'm saying this right. Langton Maltravers?
Maltravers, not a million miles away.
Yes, that was the first one in 2001. And they are quite coastal. They obviously like warm conditions. They probably come up from the continent. But they are moving inland and in a northerly direction. And when you see them on the lawn, they've been actually mining in the loose soil in lawns. And they emerge, and it's the males that emerge first. And it's quite possible to have thousands of these males all in one place. They don't sting. You haven't got to worry about them, the ones that are all together. But what they're waiting for is they're waiting for the emerging females so that they can mate. And it's traditional in nature, actually, that the males... The male of the species emerges first to establish the territory and then waits for the female. Now, the females do sting. And what do you do about them? Well, I think you said that they had flown away, or the person that told you about them said they'd flown away.
Well, they've come back.
See, there's the females out and the business of mating is over with. They will go and then they will start to visit suitable flowers, including ivy. And they probably will be around next year. Mining bees are a little bit dynamic. You get good years and bad years. And they can be predated by things like blackbirds and all sorts of other birds that will eat them. And we have a mining bee here that regularly gets clobbered by blackbirds. But I think whoever, you're very lucky to see them. I haven't seen them in my garden. And they are going to be extremely good pollinators, late pollinators. And when I asked Jeremy, you know, what he thought should happen, he simply said, just, you know, live and let live. Enjoy them.
Oh, I'm very happy for them to be in my garden.
Yes. But so I'm going to start looking at ivy flowers because they are heading north towards the Cotswolds. They've sort of got up to places like Warwickshire. So it might well be that I'll see them in my garden. So I was extremely pleased to find out about them.
Well, actually, ivy might be the key, because I have got ivy in my garden, which I curse, I have to say. There's quite a lot of ivy around, and opposite, there's a very discreet cemetery, which has got ivy. Do these little minor bees, do they travel far?
I wouldn't imagine they would travel that far, being small bees, actually. But I don't know, because obviously they've travelled to get here. You know, they must have come across probably the English Channel to actually arrive here. I don't know where their range is, so I can't actually say. But mining bees generally don't travel very, very far.
But I mean, they go to the end of the road for the sake of some ivy, would they?
Oh, yeah, they would go definitely a kilometre, 2 kilometres, but not huge distances. If you wanted to have a wildlife plant in your garden that's really good for late pollinators, it is English ivy, Hedera helix, because it's such a good late flower. It'll often be flowering in November when there's hardly anything left. And then the berries arrive in about March time, February, March time, when a lot of the berries have gone. So it's an extremely good bee plant and an extremely good bird plant. I've got it along my south-facing stone wall, and I leave a sort of stand of it to flower. And then I've got it in a sorbus tree going straight up in the tree, and that produces flowers up there.
Can I just ask you, you were talking about the mining bees.
Mm.
Do they nest? I mean, are they...
Yes, they actually burrow into the ground when the females have been mated with. The females dig a hole... and it's quite hard for them if the soil's dry. This is one of the reasons why they like loose soil, because it's easier for the bees to make a hole. And they make a chamber, and then they lay their egg down there, and that develops into a larvae, and then that emerges next year. So that will come out of the ground in about September time.
Ridgeway Magazine, on Wednesdays at 11, tackles local issues with local views from local people. With John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
And finally, we hear about the dumbest criminals, as remembered by Ron Bowers, a former prosecutor with the Los Angeles Police Department, in conversation with John.
Well, while on my travels earlier in the year, I came across a retired prosecutor for the Los Angeles Police Department. Here, he reminisces about some cases where criminals were just plain dumb, or, as we would say, plain stupid.
Ron Bowers, retired attorney from Los Angeles. Now, Sherlock had a word for what you're about to tell us.
Yes, you know, Sherlock Holmes is an interesting character, you know, in a book series. But there was one of the lines he said, "Dear Watson, you know, they should give IQ tests to criminals because they do the dumbest things." And, you know, I guess we shouldn't say criminals are dumb, but they do some of the craziest things. And over my 43 years as a prosecutor, I've come across some of them that are just unbelievable. And one of them that I always wonder how and why they did it, they went to an ATM place where you put your card in to get money, and they're standing there, and they ask the victim for his PIN number, and he gives them the PIN number because there's a gun in his back. And they're standing there, and they're being photographed. They're being photographed by the ATM machine. They're obviously going to get caught, and very easily caught. There was another one I remember. He was doing robberies, and he had a tattoo on him in his forehead. And so when we did the lineup, you know, the witnesses had an easy time of identifying him. They said, "Yes, that was the man with the
very rude tattoo."
Yeah, rude. I won't use the word that was tattooed on his forehead. So he was easily identified. The same thing is true about a number of vehicles that I've come across in my different cases. One was there was a drive-by shooting, and the drive-by shooter used a vehicle that had a big, wide stripe across the car, making it very identifiable. So the people in the neighborhood say, "Oh yeah, that's John's car. I recognize it." It seems a little stupid to use an identifiable car. And there was another one that was similar to that. They used a van that had a window that was broken out, and they had a plastic that they had duct taped in place, and they used the car in a hit, meaning they went out to kill somebody on a contract, and they jump back in the car, and something falls out of the car, and what fell out was a gas bill meaning for natural gas. And when the police came up, it looked like trash to them. They picked it up, looked at it, and it had an address. It had a name. So they followed that up, and certainly, you know, where they arrived there, there is the van with the taped window. So it was an easy murder that they were able to solve. So there have been many, many of those. And I find one of the ones that was kind of humorous is we have gang members in the jail, and they will send letters to their homies asking them to, you know, give them alibis to make up, you know, stories. And they mail those letters out to their friends. And one of the gang members didn't put any postage on the letter that he sent out. And needless to say, the post office sent the letter back, you know, insufficient funds. And the jail gets it. Of course, they open it up, and here it is. He's asking his homies to do an alibi for him.
Are all letters, incoming letters in the jails in America, opened?
Yes, everything coming in is checked out. There's no privacy as far as letters sent in. They do have privacy as far as sending letters out. So it was just one of those situations. So over the years, you know, you see a lot of these, and I remember one that I couldn't believe. These two men go over to a dope dealer's house, and they're negotiating their dope deal. Everything is fine. And then they want to rob or steal the money from the dope dealer and steal his dope, which they do. And they run out and get into their car, and the police happen to be fairly close by, and they take off, and they hit a car in front of them. It was a pickup truck, and it knocked their bumper of their car off, and on the bumper, as you may know, is the license plate number. So when the police arrived there, there was the bumper with the license plate number. The police go over to the registered owner of that, find out who the lady's car was. She says, "Oh, yeah, my son was driving it. He's upstairs right now, and he was arrested for an attempt murder."
Well, there we are. Actually, there was another one that I heard you talking about, something about a gated community.
Well, there was another one. It was a similar one regarding narcotics. And these guys were pretty sharp. They had been around a long time. They knew they could get a lot of money from, because, you know, the narcotic dealings are in cash. So they go over there, they decide to buy the narcotics, and then they pull out the guns and they rob the dealer and take everything, all of his money and all of his dope. They had parked their car next to the house because it was trash day and they didn't want their car to be hit by the trash truck. So when they come out and jump in their car to take off after shooting the dealer, they find that the gate, the wrought iron gate, has been pulled shut and locked. They can't get their car out, so they don't know what to do. They abandon their car, and they take all this dope, and they drop it in all the trash cans along the way in order to escape. But they didn't really get too far because their car was left there. It had a license plate. We tracked down the registered owner, who was one of the shooters. And also, when we looked in the car, there was a day planner. And when we looked at the day planner, we found out the name of the other shooter. So we ended up getting both of them convicted of first-degree murder just because their car got locked up and they couldn't get away.
Well, dumb and dumber springs to mind there. Thank you very much there to Ron Bowers, a former prosecutor with the LAPD. Well, we've come to the end of the show today. John, tell us what's going to be in the next programme.
Well, I can't reveal everything, of course.
Oh, no.
Because actually, this is a live programme and we don't make up our minds about what's going into the show until about 48 hours before. Ah. But hedgehogs will be a subject.
Okay. All right.
I've got one in my garage.
Oh.
And I need to need
a visitor.
I need to know more.
And that's all we have time for today on Ridgeway Magazine. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Join us again next time on Wednesday at 11. After the news, it's the Soul and Funk Hour here on Keep 106. From John and me, for now, it's cheerio